Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. So you can hide a presidential candidate in a campaign during a pandemic with the media, D.C. press corps, providing a net for him as their favorite choice. But at some point when you become president of the United States, if that does happen, as it did, you're going to be operating without a net. And that comes when policy choices you made put American lives in jeopardy. And that's where President Biden was yesterday, even with the orchestrated softball interview by Clinton Foundation donor Zero. Anything could have gone better over the last 3 months, the last 96 hours?
When you look at what's happened over the last week, was it a failure of intelligence, planning, execution, or judgment?
Look, I don't think it was a fair look. It was a simple choice, George. When the Taliban, let me back it, put it another way. When you had the government of Afghanistan, the leader of that government getting in a plane and taking off and going to another country, when you saw the significant collapse of the Afghan troops we had trained, up to 300,000 of them, just leaving their equipment and taking off. That was, you know, that's what happened. That's simply what happened.
But we've all seen the pictures. We've seen those hundreds of people packed into a C-17. We've seen Afghans falling.
That was 4 days ago, 5 days ago.
What did you think when you first saw those pictures?
What I thought was we have to gain control of this. We have to move this more quickly. We have to move in a way in which we can take control of that airport. And we did.
So you don't think this could have been handled? This actually could have been handled better in any way? No mistakes?
No, I don't think it could have been handled in a way that we're going to go back in hindsight and look. But the idea that somehow there's a way to have gotten out without chaos ensuing, I don't know how that happens. I don't know how that happened.
So for you, that was always priced into the decision?
Yes.
Clearly.
Yeah.
I don't have an idea about how to get out of this without chaos ensuing. We've seen. But that doesn't mean that the choice that you made, choices, because there was a string of them, as there usually is when a catastrophic event occurs, a string of bad decisions. That doesn't mean that those choices you made were the only choices that could have been made. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636DA, turnkey.protect.
And he gets so defensive. And when he said, you know, it was 4 or 5 days ago, so just dismissive. I mean, people died. People were horrified. One of the kids, it was a child, a 17-year-old, who fell off that plane. He and his 16-year-old brother wanted to try and get out because they're fearful of the Taliban because they knew they would get killed, so they risked their lives. Does Biden care about them? No. They don't even care about the Americans that are still stuck there.
Well, he said we needed to gain control of the airport, and we did. Sort of.
Not really.
The story is yesterday, rescue mission Afghanistan in chaos. U.S. troops fire shots and tell 11,000-odd Americans that they have to make their own way to the airport. Okay, so they make their own way to the airport. I see. And this is the combination, the brain trust here, the best and the brightest of the modern-day neo-Marxist left. General Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, he put down his Robin DiAngelo oeuvre for just a minute to do a press briefing yesterday. And Lloyd Austin, who put down his Ibram Kendi favorites to join Milley. So you've got the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. You got the Secretary of Defense. Listen to what both of them say. So Milley on working with the Taliban for safe passage. We've got control of the situation. We have control of the airport. It's fine, Biden intimates. Here's what General Milley says.
Let me make one comment on the intelligence, because I'm seeing all over the news that there are warnings of a rapid collapse. I have previously said from this podium and in sworn testimony before Congress that the intelligence clearly indicated multiple scenarios were possible. One of those was an outright Taliban takeover following a rapid collapse of the Afghan security forces and the government. Another was a civil war, and a third was a negotiated settlement. However, the time frame of a rapid collapse, that was widely estimated and ranged from weeks to months and even years following our departure. There was nothing that I or anyone else saw that indicated a collapse of this army and this government in 11 days.
Mm-hmm. More Milley than Austin.
How can the U.S., the Pentagon, live up to that task of evacuating all Americans, because we continue to see the violence just outside the airport? And how would you get them in around the country unless you go get them?
Well, two things, Barbara. One is State Department, as you know, as I've said, is working with the Taliban to facilitate safe passage of American citizens, U.S. passport holders, to the airport. And that's the primary means, and under the current conditions, that's the primary effort. We have capability to do other things if necessary.
Well, can I ask you what that means? Because you also said there were international special forces there that have a capability to extract, and those words suggest very clearly in the military realm you would go get people.
Well, that would be a policy decision, and if directed, we have capabilities that can execute whatever we're directed.
Thank you. Louis.
And I would draw a distinction, Barb, between extracting someone in an in extremis condition or circumstance versus going out and collecting up large numbers of American citizens.
Do you have the capability to go out and collect Americans?
We don't have the capability to go out and collect up large numbers of people, Barb.
That's the Secretary of Defense. Just give up. We gave up.
So extracting 11,000 Americans, we're going to outsource that to the Taliban, international special forces, and those Americans who can make their way to the airport, when we know we've got problems getting to the airport in Kabul.
I mean, his whole administration, they should all be fired. Secretary of Defense, Milley, Joint Chiefs of Staff, Secretary of State, who's in charge of protecting American civilians overseas. Yeah. Are they doing a good job? No, they're not. But Biden, I mean, he keeps digging himself into a deeper hole. Dangerously and completely incompetent.
International Special Forces, they're going to be tasked with rescuing Americans from Afghanistan. 20 years ago, it was, we don't negotiate with terrorists. Today, it's, we're going to ask the Taliban if they'll provide safe passage for Americans to leave. That's the descent of American, well, might by our own hands, mainly. What is the U.S. military? The Greyhound Bus Company? You have
the Greyhound Bus Company is more organized than us right now.
You have to come to us? We've got this stop. If you can make it to the stop, then you can get home. That's how it's going to be? By the way, something else, too, since Joe Biden has such a handle on it. Do you have all the names of the Americans? Have all the names?
Do you know where they work? What department they're with?
What are we working off of?
Where's the list?
Because we have different assessments of how many Americans are there. Wide assessments. Anywhere from 5 to 40,000 are the varying estimates I've seen. We also have all the Afghan allies. And how many of those do we have? And are you working off a list? Or is that being outsourced to no one left behind, the nonprofit? And where are they supposed to get the military resources to extract all of those Afghan allies?
The only thing that's for sure, I know there's 300 members of the European Union that are there that are trying to get out. That's it. But we don't have a list of Americans?
International Special Forces are charged with this. So so they have to get to the airport. We're negotiating with the Taliban for safe passage. It's on a first-come, first-served basis. So what happens if the Taliban say, oh, okay, safe passage, and then, you know, being terrorists, death to America types, they renege. The security situation deteriorates at the airport. What if, since it's at a first-come, first-served basis, you just tell the, let's use the number, 11,000 Americans there right now, all come to the airport, and they get there in droves, and then the security situation deteriorates. Then what do you got?
And they're like, oh, there's flights every hour on the hour. You know, like we're going from Chicago to Vegas or something.
The Pentagon said yesterday morning, between Tuesday 3 a.m. and Wednesday 3 a.m., 2,000 passengers were flown out of Kabul, but there were just 325 Americans of the 2,000. Because the problem you have, it seems, based on the reporting and stories like that, is getting to the airport. We're waiting for you if you can make it.
We're here. We're ready to go. Please fasten your seatbelts.
This is like Argo writ large.
Put on your mask. Oh, yeah, you're right. It is.
Marty in Naperville, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning. I think after listening to those two dopes talk, my question is answered. I don't understand. I thought this from the minute we got it. If we got all these Taliban fighters and we knew where all these leaders are now in Kabul area, why the hell don't we just take them all out? I don't get this thing. Just kill them.
Well, thanks for the call, Marty. I'm sure it's more complicated than just carpet bombing the area.
Yeah.
Because, of course, you have civilians. You have Afghan allies. I'm sure it's more complicated than
that. Well, you have Americans there right now, Marty. There's our brothers and sisters are over there. So, no, we're not going to carpet bomb anybody.
Yeah. And I'm not suggesting that's what he's saying. However, the default position of we can extract individuals in extremist positions, as Austin said. We have no ability to extract large numbers of people. You have to make your way to the airport. It's on a first-come, first-served basis. That leaves a lot of questions. And the underlying predicate is, I guess, since they're standing there together, I assume that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Secretary of Defense talk, the pathway to the airport is through Taliban acquiescence. That demands a lot more questions than were asked either by Stephanopoulos or the rest of the D.C. press corps with respect to those two, the DOD and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. Tim in Woodstock.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. You know, here almost reminded me a little bit of Hillary Clinton when she tried to defend her ineptness by saying, you know, at this point, what difference does it make? You know, but I guess five days is enough time for some Americans to begin forgetting already. But he said that just shortly, not long ago, he said there was no possibility that something like this could happen, that we could see helicopters extracting people off the top of buildings. It was incomparable to Vietnam, he said. And now in the interview that you just played, he's pulling the card out. Well, what did you expect? You know,
right?
This was inevitable.
What are we supposed to do? Yeah.
But just a few days ago, there was no possibility. You know, the enemy they keep rant, you know, going on and on about it being a 20-year war, and yeah, there's an argument that it's been too long, but it's been that the enemy's been neutralized for some time. You know, and I know you've been saying this. They've been neutralized for some time, and for him to go in there and do this so quickly and put our military at risk, the people have helped us. And I'd also like to speak up. And, you know, one thing I do on my Facebook page is I have a little segment that I sort of from time to time bring up. And that's what happens to Christians around the world when American leftists who claim to be Christians vote for Democrats. And in this case, particularly Joe Biden, because they've just made the Christians, the brave Christians in Afghanistan, who convert much of their own risk and go on living much of their own risk, they've just made it a nightmare for them. And that's something that every American, anyone who claims to be a Christian ought to think long and hard. You think politics doesn't matter to God at all? You couldn't be more wrong.
Thanks for the call, Tim. By the way, Hillary Clinton now apparently a consultant to Canadian PM Justin Trudeau on Afghanistan policy. He's been consulting with Hillary Clinton about what to do in Afghanistan. Of course he has.
Oh, God.
Thing, too, on Milley's intelligence estimates. You know, no one, it was 90 days, it was this, it was that. No one predicted that it was going to be.
The CIA knew. They told Biden administration.
Here's what they're doing. They're saying, here is an intelligence estimate at one point. Here's another intelligence estimate at another point. They're pretending there's not a timeline. They're pretending they were all presented at the same time. That's not true, because the intelligence estimates continued. The trajectory was continued deterioration, continued suggestion that things were getting more and more dire, that it was more and more likely for Afghanistan to fall to the Taliban. That was the actual estimates. Nobody predicted it was be on this day and this time period. But listen, New York Times Pentagon correspondent Helene Cooper, New York Times, listen to what she said about what they knew.
The argument you're getting from some people in the White House is there was no consensus. It wasn't a high degree of confidence from the intel community that things were going to go as sideways as fast as it did. And the reality is nobody, even the intel community, even the people who thought, okay, now we're looking at 30 days. Now we're looking at maybe, you know, this could be a lot faster than it ended up being. Even those people, nobody thought things were going to happen as soon as it did. Not a single member of this administration, intel community, military, none of them thought we were going to see Kabul fall this past weekend. That was a shock to all of them.
Right, this past weekend. But in an attempt to provide exculpatory evidence to the Biden administration, Helene Cooper inadvertently indicts them. It was going to happen a lot quicker than we initially thought. There wasn't a quote unquote consensus. Well, you get intelligence estimates. There's always going to be contingency. This could happen. That could happen. But here's the direction of the situation there. And then the best and brightest minds we allegedly have, the Millies and the Austins and the Jake Sullivans, are supposed to tell the president. You know, what is the most likely scenario, and then actually live up to the talking point that they issued, that they plan for every possible event. And of course, obviously they didn't, which is the biggest lie that's been told so far and the most obscene lie that's been told so far.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Good piece by Vivek Ramaswamy, who is the author of this new book, Woke Inc. We talked about him before, efforting to get him on the show. He's a Harvard grad who saw from the inside big Wall Street companies what has happened to corporate America. He writes in the New York Post, Afghanistan, ghastly display of how wokeness weakens America. What we have allowed America to become in so many ways domestically has an impact on what we're able to do internationally. As he writes, fragility at home begets fragility abroad. The geopolitical consequences of wokeism were painfully on display during our ignominious departure from Afghanistan. The only way to have ensured an orderly exit from Afghanistan was to impress the fear of total decimation upon the Taliban in response to malign behavior, yet Biden made no such threat. And even if he had, the Taliban would have known he wouldn't have followed through on it. When the commander-in-chief of the United States obsessively criticizes our country, including by claiming, as Biden did, that systemic racism stains our national soul, Washington loses its moral standing to project strength abroad precisely at the moments when we need it most. The Taliban exploited this grim reality to the fullest extent. This was no tactical failure. It was a failure of moral leadership. Every minute that our military spent this year teaching our troops about white privilege should have been spent cultivating American idealism and projecting it abroad in ways that give us the moral authority to do what needs to be done under extraordinary circumstances like the ones we've encountered this week. If an American president doesn't believe in American exceptionalism, no one else will either. You know, it's interesting. It's a good point. It's not a novel one. It's a point that's been made for the better part of the last three decades as the Democrat socialist left has increasingly become overtly, explicitly hostile to America. And that has, as Ramaswamy writes, geopolitical consequences. Moral authority matters. The belief in your adversaries that you will do the things you threaten to do if they continue their malign behavior, that matters. And we're seeing how it matters in full color this week. Another point he made about what's happened to American companies, as over that same period of time, Fortune 100 companies have become increasingly hostile to America. Maybe Fortune 500. Another factor compounded our compromised geopolitical position. America's top companies have turned their backs on America. Just this week, Twitter effectively aided the Taliban in their coup by permitting them to tweet to hundreds of thousands of followers as they seized control of the presidential palace in Kabul.
But they took away President Trump's Twitter account.
Right.
But they give a voice to the Taliban.
Companies like Disney and Nike regularly criticize the United States, even as they obsequiously praise the genocidal Communist Party in China. These corporate actions further contribute to a growing moral relativistic perception of America on the global stage. If the same companies that criticize the United States for injustice say nothing bad about the Taliban or the Beijing regime, that implicitly bolsters the moral standing of the latter at the expense of the former. Exactly. It's precisely correct. And this is, in part, just in part, what it begets. So, you know, when we assess presidential campaigns, because the D.C. press corps is so myopic and in the tank for the left, we pretend like domestic policy and cultural issues, they're in a silo over here on the left side. And over here on the right side is where we talk about foreign policy, and never shall the two meet. Well, that's, of course, nonsense. They're inextricably linked. The American culture is what informs how we train military men and women, to the point of the author I was referencing. And American values and the principles and positions on which a president runs and wins and then projects from the Oval Office, that has geopolitical consequences. So when we talk about all these issues domestically, even at the granular level, the local school board level, don't think that it's not a daisy chain that encompasses everything America does on this mortal coil and how our enemies respond to what America does. John in his car.
And I guess self-accountability is out the window, huh? I mean, my question is, what are they doing there? I mean, I could see maybe the embassy people sticking around to the 11th hour, but all these other supposed 5 to 40,000, what are you doing there? It's not like they didn't know this was coming. That makes no sense. So I don't feel too bad for them.
Oh, really?
Oh, come on.
Really? Come on. You know, they can be could be contractors. They could be families of, you know, people that have business interests there. I don't know what those business interests would be. Part of this is I'd like an inventory. I mean, not necessarily publicly, because I don't want these individuals identified and targeted. But you'd like to know that there's an inventory. There's a manifest, if you will, of the Americans there and the Afghan allies, because we need to keep our promises there, too, because not keeping our promises to our allies in Afghanistan, those who are special immigrant visa designees and who assisted the U.S. military, that has geopolitical implications, too, for generations to come.
Does Biden know that the whole world is watching this complete embarrassment?
Pete and Racine.
Didn't even know what day it was yesterday. My God.
Good morning. Say, what boils my blood with Biden is when I just listened to the news broadcast again when he said, what do you expect except chaos? If we break this down to common man, anybody that's played poker or these big guys that play for $1.5 million, they when they get their cards, they don't hold them up and show everybody, hey, look what I got, then hope to win that hand. And that's what Biden did, is he showed everybody his cards all along here, what he was going to do. So he lost all his money, and it cost us in the long run.
Thanks, Pete. Mike in Union.
Morning, Dan and Amy. How are you?
Good.
So, you know, going back when Trump was president and he was trying to hold the Ukrainians accountable for corruption and was withholding arms, everybody was up in arms that he was betraying our allies, and all these diplomats and everybody were screaming from the hills and impeachment and all these special hearings. Where is that now, and where's the articles of impeachment? And then lastly, I heard that Hillary Clinton was going to be advising Justin Trudeau. Maybe this is the Biden answer to the Argo, where maybe she's going to consult them and the Canadians on how to rescue Americans overseas. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Mike. So
it reminds me of Benghazi, because we're leaving Americans behind.
You know, the whole loose talk about impeachment and resignations. Somebody emailed me that
Amendment.
Steve Bannon was talking about when Biden and Harris resign. What are you talking about?
They're not going to resign, and they're going to keep their buddies, the Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State.
I mean, has no one who believes that paid any attention to the complete absence of accountability for leftists in government, regardless of their crimes or criminal incompetence? Here's what I think. I mean, I wasn't in the Trump administration and so on and so forth, so I know people are impressed with titles and positions, regardless of how people performed when they had those titles or were in those positions. But barring a massacre of Americans there, God forbid, once the dust settles, maybe Milley and or Austin slink away quietly. Milley's term is up at the end of September, so maybe he retires quietly.
To spend more time with his family.
Because have you also not noticed something else? Half the country is comfortable to limp along, to rationalize their decision to dump Trump by any means necessary and ignore any unpleasantness. You haven't noticed the complete absence of accountability for leftists in government, regardless of what they do. I mean, the only time they're negatively impacted is when they become a political liability, like handsy Andy Cuomo. And you haven't noticed where half the country is? That's what I'm saying. All of this is part of the landscape upon which the people we're discussing, Biden and his team, make decisions. Because, of course, they're always, every politician is, at least in part, some more so than others, looking at these decisions through a domestic political lens. How does it impact me and my party politically? Impeachment, resignations, take stock of where we are versus where you think we are for those people who are making that claim seriously.
You had mentioned Vice President Kamala Harris. Where has she been? I have not seen her publicly in 3 weeks. I thought maybe she was on vacation, but now it's, do you have any, because remember she went to Walter Reed Hospital after interacting with those Democratic lawmakers from Texas.
She's
who had COVID.
She's planned. She's got a planned visit to Southeast Asia. She's going to Vietnam.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Starting Friday, she's in Southeast Asia. Boy, she was really out there trying to claim partial credit for the decision back in April. Well, there's plenty of credit to go around now, Kamala.
Yeah, where are you?
Mm-hmm. Jim in Sheboygan.
So there are a lot of similarities to what we're seeing now in Afghanistan to what happened in Benghazi, and a lot of the same players are in the administration as well in advising Biden, including Susan Rice. So yeah, Benghazi happens, they get attacked, and what do? They stand down. They don't go in and rescue them. They leave them behind. That's exactly, they didn't look at these contingencies. This is a similar situation where they didn't consider it important about the people left behind. You talked earlier, Dan, about the denigration of our moral high ground over 20 years, and it's the same thing with leaving people behind. they're doing the same thing as they did in Benghazi, and now the talking points are the same as what they did in Benghazi. And we thoroughly looked at Benghazi. We knew that Benghazi was a disaster, and it's happening again in Afghanistan. Nobody was held accountable. Nobody was held accountable. In fact, she ran for president.
Thanks for the call, Jim. I mean, just for anybody who's still tilting at these windmills, listening to, and frankly, some other talk show hosts that are conservatives who are just, I don't know if they really believe this or they are just trying
acting.
To feed red meat to the base or something. It's irresponsible. It's ridiculous, actually. Stories that we're not paying attention to right now because of what's going on in Afghanistan. Republicans demand IRS explain why Christian group was denied tax exemption. Didn't we just do this in Joe Obama terms one and two with Lois Lerner? A decade later, anybody held accountable at IRS for the unconstitutional targeting of Christian and conservative groups in terms of their access to 501c3 status, their assessments? Show me what prayers you're going to say before we consider your application. And a decade later, what do we got? The same thing. FBI knew of Hunter Biden's missing laptop as early as December of 2019. How's that FBI investigation into Hunter Biden going? How many years does that take? Will we get that at the same time the Durham report is delivered? And, oh, by the way, in addition to all that, which a lot of which happened when Republicans were in charge of both the legislative and executive branch, what do we have now? They're in charge of nothing. Honestly, very reckless, some of the things I'm hearing. Don't lead people down primrose paths. Jordan in Antioch.
Good morning. Yeah, you're right. As a nation, we have about a 3.5-second attention span, and they're going to play the same cards as they did before. The only difference is when Benghazi happened, there was no video of it. I mean, there was, but not to the extent that they have now on this. And as much as I hate to say it, as much as this is a tragedy, this needs to be ground into the face of every single person that on the other side of this issue. And until he doesn't get a pass, and General CRT and Major White Rage, they got to go too. And the American people need to wake up. There's a lot of new Republicans running to push out the old, quote-unquote, old guard that want to distract you from the real issues. The problem is we have an administration on both sides that's very anti-American and very pro-LinkedIn resume model. And that's all this is a blip on their resume.
Yeah.
We can't let this happen.
Thanks for the call, Jordan. Something else, too. This can't become like 11,000 Americans. This can't be some abstract data point number. It needs to be storytelling. The same way that the D.C. press corps tells the story of every person with any public profile who gets infected with COVID.
Or it was the Capitol on January 6th. They dive deep. Where are the interviews now?
Ever.
With Americans that are stuck there? I mean, they have social media. We should hear their stories.
Well,
where are they? Why can't they get to the airport? Talk to us.
Yeah, it'd be interesting. I mean, for those that do have access to social media and can mask their identities and locations too, because I think that's the environment there. That's certainly the impression I'm getting. Candace in Mount Pleasant.
And I watched Laura Logan on Fox Nation. Tucker Carlson was interviewing her. Because remember, you guys, back in the Obama administration, when she had that interview with that Taliban guy in the back of a car, and then she went to that big press conference, and they booed her because she said the Taliban is very much alive. And Obama's narrative was that the Taliban was on the run, remember? So last night, she basically said that this whole narrative is BS, and she basically laid out why they're lying. And it was interesting. She just said, we have complete control over there. If we wanted control, they don't want control. They want to create chaos. And I think the reason why they want the chaos is because they want to bring like 80% of Afghanistan over here.
No, no.
Yeah.
No,
yep.
Absolutely
wrong.
Not. No,
that's silly. It's absolutely silly. That's what I'm talking about. Right. They're so exquisitely competent. They're like the conductors of the New York Philharmonic. No. That's not what's happening. And, you know, it would be useful to focus on the rank order priorities, the manifest failures, bump that up against the competence of these individuals, and keep people's attention where it belongs rather than on spinning yarns 80% of Afghanistan over here. That's absurd. Right. We're going to remake America. I've heard this too. We're going to remake America by importing the entirety of Kabul, warts and all, sort
of
speak.
Yeah, just to get the Democratic vote. No, that's what I heard too. It's not true.
The border issue is one thing. Suggesting that about this situation in this moment is just plain silly.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Well, let's offer some good news among all the dreary business of the day. Unfortunately, both here at home and across the way in Afghanistan, we were discussing last hour. The Yanez family, the family of Carlos Yanez, released a video of him in his own words yesterday, showing how much his condition has improved, for which we're very thankful.
Thank you. Thank you for your support, your donations, and your prayers. I love you all. To my son, CJ, and my wife, Brenda, I did this all for you.
So just offering thanks to people who've been supportive, who've made donations, as well as, of course, to his family. And it's just, it's nice to see not only that he's able to speak, but that he has the, remember, you know,
He got shot in the left eye.
Took a headshot.
And has a bullet lodged in the back of his skull.
And, but has the cognitive, remembering his wife's name, is, you know, so on and so forth. His family offered some statements yesterday too, starting with Dad.
The police family has always been unified. I was a police officer for 25 years and I saw it, but I've never seen it as much as it is now for Officer French and my son Carlos Jr.
And of course, Officer French's service was yesterday.
Yeah, she had a wake, and it's so nice to see people that never even knew her. People, you know, firefighters, family members, EMTs, of course, police officers from other districts, and people from all over the country came to say their goodbyes.
My dad was a Chicago policeman for over 35 years, and it's just paying respect.
It's a shame, you know, that there's no respect for them anymore, and that's what we need.
My daughter-in-law is a correctional officer out of Statesville, and you worry about them every day. So I think it's very important to be out here and pray for them.
This world is just falling apart, and the police are getting no respect, and they really, truly are. What would we do without them?
What would we do without them? And the big story this morning, or the big story, but what's making rounds on social media is that the family asked for no politicians. They didn't want Superintendent Brown, but Superintendent Brown, you know, showed up to the wake. Governor Pritzker did, but Mayor Lightfoot crashed the wake. And I say that because, according to people that were there, she snuck in through the back door. And this is after she was asked when she went to visit Officer Yanez on the 7th floor of the hospital. They told her, do not come here. And she went anyway. I mean, a person of integrity should know when it's appropriate to show up or when it's best to just stay home. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. Officers that saw her there, they took pictures and sent it to Alderman Lopez and others, you know, to say, oh, look who showed up after specifically being told, please, you do not have our backs. We do not want you here. And they were respectful. They didn't do anything. You know, there was no civil disobedience or anything. They didn't turn their back on her. They just watched her walk in, and then she left a few minutes later.
Well,
tone deaf is she there, Dan?
Yeah, well, that's the least of her sins is her tone deafness. And so, you know, we are happy about the condition of Officer Carlos Yanez, that it's improving, obviously. Mourn the loss of Ella French or Fitzgerald or Frank. I'm surprised that she showed up to the right wake.
Oh, yeah, because she couldn't get her name right.
I thought maybe she'd be looking for the Ella Frank wake. It's remarkable. But then you have these stories. The 67-year-old special ed teacher from Orland Park who was shot in the Dan Ryan coming home from the Sox game. So a friend, somebody who emails me routinely, listener to the show, his sister, I mean, this is like three steps removed, but, you know,
but it's still
very clannish on
family.
The South Side.
Yeah, they are. In a good way.
His sister is friends with one of the couples that was part of with the one of the two couples that was in the car that had both gone to the Sox game together. And actually her...
her friend got a bullet wound, well, was grazed with a bullet.
Yeah. And her I think this friend that he referred me to, that their parents were supposed to go or the mom was supposed to go but couldn't because they had some other conflict. Anyway, they were driving home with another couple. All of a sudden, she said to her husband, "I've been shot." Then she slumped over, blood everywhere. I guess the bullet went through the taillight and hit her in the chest. They drove till it was safe so no one else would get shot while also calling the ambulance. Then the ambulance took her while I think the husband and the couple in the car drove to the hospital holding hands and praying.
You're not safe anywhere. And she was so celebrated and so loved, and some of her former students spoke yesterday about, you know, how she has changed their lives. And black kids and brown kids and white kids, and what a wonderful teacher she was.
Two cars shooting at each other in the southbound lanes just after 10 p.m. near 67th and the Dan Ryan when some of the shots hit two other vehicles, a white SUV, red sedan, grazed the one lady in that car in which Denise Hugolette was murdered.
People don't even take the Dan Ryan or certain expressways because they're fearful of shootings. They'll go around and take side streets.
I told you I was just like 2 seconds ahead of the shooting that happened a week ago Friday night on the Dan Ryan when I was driving back from Olympia Fields. 33rd in the Dan Ryan, 6:48 p.m. That was the time I read in the paper the next day. I saw the car. I saw the passenger side backseat window go down. I saw two cars jockeying for position. It looked like it was confrontational. Turned out to be confrontational. Nobody's in custody there. I mean, I was, you know, sort of rearview mirror viewing it.
Yeah, but
I was
you were
speeding
there.
Ahead.
I didn't see it.
But I mean, yeah. I mean, I'll just be honest. I drive the Dan Ryan a lot because I go down to Olympia Fields to play golf. And I have my gun on my driver's seat when I drive the Dan Ryan, which I actually otherwise like because I like Fury Road, but I'm not going to make light of it in this sort of context when you have a woman with her husband and another couple just coming back from a Sox game and you lose your wife to a shooting. That's where it's at. And it's here, too, in Chatham. Chicago family dealing with the loss of a 26-year-old mom killed in a drive-by shooting just days before her son's 7th birthday. The 6-year-old family, the family said Christina DeJesus' little boy, the 6-year-old, pleaded with nurses in the emergency room to wake his mom up. Tomorrow is my birthday and my mom's throwing me a party.
Oh.
I mean, you just can't make this about statistics anymore because the stats don't matter to anybody. I mean,
and so, I go
so you have to tell stories.
Yeah, and the University of Chicago student who was going home from his internship on the Green Line, remember when he got shot in the neck and couldn't talk or or breathe on his own. And he said to his mother through his blinking, I don't want to live like this. Please take me off the machine.
That's the Chicago we like.
6 and 7 year olds shot. 3 o'clock in the afternoon on Sunday, last Sunday, going home after spending the afternoon with grandma, having brunch, and get shot. And people assume the dad's a gangbanger. He's like, I work for the CTA. I'm a bus driver. I don't have any enemies. Case of mistaken identity. People just randomly shooting, and the bullet went right through her heart, the little 7 girl's heart. And she and her sister, who were both shot, were hugging each other. And that's how she died, in her sister's arms.
This is such a dark place, and I'm so tired of making policy arguments that I had to consult the writings of Charles Bukowski, who's about as dark and messed up as you get. It's a great writer, though. Did you ever read Factotum, or even see the biopic of him called Factotum, based on his book that Matt Dillon played Charles Bukowski? Pretty good, we're seeing. But it's dark, and he was a hot mess. Nonetheless, his poem, Those Sons of Bitches. The dead dance with the dead. The dead sleep with the dead. The dead eat with the dead. The dead get hungry looking at hogsheads. The dead get richer. The dead get deader. Those sons of bitches. This graveyard above the ground. One tombstone for the mess. I say, humanity, you never had it from the beginning. I don't want to turn this into a poetry slam, but I'd encourage you to consider that sort of darkness.
It's such a sad place.
Because that's that's what Chicago is.
312-642-5600. Turnkey Depro. Answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Doug in Oak Lawn.
Hey, good morning, Dan. Morning, Amy. I'm just wondering, where's the outrage from the Reverend Flager? And, they keep talking about social programs, but don't they know right from wrong?
Yeah, I know.
They're soulless. I mean, there's a woman who was carjacked. Everyone's getting carjacked, by the way. And she said, I looked in the kid's eyes, and he had no soul. There was nothing there. And she's moving because he's getting out of jail. Well, I'm surprised he hasn't already bonded out. But when she said that, that resonated with a lot of people. Like, these people have no soul. They have no God. They have nothing. They don't value human life.
The aunt of the 26-year-old mom who was killed, murdered yesterday at Chatham. The city has to be reclaimed by people who want to live. I thought that's an interesting statement. It's sort of the consistent with the Bukowski poem.
Tales of War.
The dead. Right, it's the dead. We're dead from the neck up. We're dead inside. We walk around doing pro forma exercises, making pro forma statements. Barbarism. Joe in Lincoln Park.
Yeah, I'm going to guess that shooting on the Dan Ryan. I'm going to guess that those individuals that did the shooting broke at least five or six gun laws. But I'm so glad that these politicians feel like maybe the 7th or 8th gun law would have stopped that. When are we just going to stop criminals, Dan? When are we just going to say, if you have a gun illegally, you go to jail for 20 years. That's it. Put a stop to this madness by punishing the criminals.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks, Joe. Roy and Glen Ellen.
Yeah, I thought $90,000 a year Rokhan hired by DART was supposed to solve all these expressway shootings.
Uh-huh.
Weird.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Thanks for the call. Well, yeah, where to begin with the personnel decisions in the city and Cook County? Yeah, is that what Rose making, 90 grand at DART's office?
I don't know. Uh-huh. I could ask.
Oh, it's public record.
Public record.
We could FOIA it if we were that interested in what Tom DART's doing. Tom DART, Cook County Sheriff, celebrated Democrat, Southside, Irish, right, all that. Bang up job. No, but I know it's not his fault. It's Fox's fault. It's Lightfoot's fault. It's Evans' fault. And then Evans says, no, it's Fox's fault.
It's Cook County East Department.
And then Lightfoot said, no, it's Fox's fault.
Then Preckwinkle says, back off, everybody calm down. And then it starts all over again.
Do you like this group we've got? Because we've had them for a long time. I mean, Lightfoot's the most recent addition.
She's the newbie,
obviously,
who crashes wakes.
But we've had this has been, I mean, it's just rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic. We've had all of these people in one form or fashion. They just had different names for a long, long time. You like it? Yeah, the answer is yes. Marvin in Burlington.
Yeah, you answered Michael. Yeah, absolutely, they love it. Because you spoke of the popularity polls that were taken by, I don't know, somebody a couple of days ago.
Yeah, WGN News poll.
Popularity numbers that are going to get them reelected. So this is exactly what the citizens want. I think they should maybe, they're asking for more of it, aren't they?
Thanks for the call, Marvin. Tom in Blue Island.
Hey, Dan and Amy, good morning. Dan, Mike, just two questions. And the one is, it's as if this chaos is intentional. There has to be some form of that. Getting back to the Afghanistan thing, it's like the chaos is intentional. That said,
it's not intentional. It's like we're going to create chaos. It's the result of being an ideologue. They're ideologues. Right. That's the issue.
The other day in Blue Island here, I climbed up. I have a Foldo ladder in the back of my van. Pulled it out to climb up and look at a roof real quick. Well, someone about a block and a half away had robbed a dollar store. As God is my judge, was on this roof for no more than 2 minutes. I came back and my van was gone. And the guy was driving down the street with the gate open and back.
Really?
And what's to say... And, you know, I consider myself a positive person. What's to say if I wasn't on the ground that the guy would have just shot me and taken the van? Maybe I was fortunate I was on the roof. 30 seconds later, a squad pulls up. I said, hey, guys, somebody just grabbed my van. He goes, yeah, it's probably the same guy that just knocked over the dollar store. Or that I shouldn't say knocked over. He said robbed, which could mean shoplifting or whatever. I think if it was some kind of a... you know, like a hold up, there would have been a little more news on it, but he was probably just shoplifting right through the alley. I mean, a million to one shot. But I've jettisoned any idea that I'm going to get that van back.
Oh, yeah.
But now we live in a society where you have to look at it like definitely... you're happy that you didn't get shot.
Yeah. No, you're right. I mean, I'm sorry that happened to you. Obviously,
they got my golf clubs, Dan. They got my golf club.
Oh, that's now.
That's
unacceptable.
That makes it a death penalty eligible crime.
Oh, damn. And he's against capital punishment.
Today, guys.
Thanks, Tom. Tom in Deer Park.
Well, speaking of politicians, dark souls, and all around darkness, I'm just curious, Dan, because I've been offline a little bit. I know Cardinal Supich took 3 days to come out and make a statement about the slain officer and her partner, and said zero about the heroics of the people that caught him. But then three paragraphs down in his statement, he went full politician and talked about straw purchases. And nowhere in his political statement did he say a word about the priors on these murderers and how they were walking the streets, and not a word. So I'm just curious, because I've been offline. His Lieutenant Supich made any statements or anything since then? Mm-hmm. Is it just me? Am I bitter?
No, I think that's a fair criticism of Supich. Thanks, Tom.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Well, if and when your kids return to the classroom at the government school system, and frankly, a lot of the private schools too, the Zoom learning may be over, but I would encourage you to make sure they're still filming what's happening in the classroom so you can see it upon their return home from school.
Yeah.
Why do I say this? Yet another example of what's actually happening in schools with these neo-Marxist educators, these dim bulbs that get phony baloney degrees from mediocre universities and then believe they are oracles of wisdom imparting great knowledge on the kids.
Yeah.
This teacher in Lehi, Utah.
Yeah, it's one of the most conservative municipalities in the state, by the way, so keep that in mind. Yeah, and she let kids know how she felt about being back at school.
I hate Donald Trump. I'm going to say it. I don't care what y'all think. Trump sucks. He's a sexual predator. He's a literal moron.
This is chemistry class.
Yeah, chemistry. And they don't give a crap. Yes. No, he is not.
What are you talking about?
Turn off the Fox News. Do your parents listen to Fox News? So what? This is my classroom, and if you guys are going to put me at risk, you're going to hear about it. Because I have to be here. I don't have to be happy about the fact that there's kids coming in here with their variants that could possibly get me or my family sick. That's rude. And I'm not going to pretend like it's not. So don't ask
you
me
have
to.
All the right. You have
that's
all the
right. Damn right. I'm not going to pretend. I'm not going to lie. If you ask me a legit question, I'm not going to lie. I'm not going to sugarcoat it either. Because y'all need to hear the truth.
Hey, I'm 100% agree. You have an opinion. I'm also
you don't have to be, though. That's the thing. Most of y'all parents are dumber than you. I'm going to say that out loud. My parents are freaking dumb. Okay? And the minute I figured that out, the world opens up. You don't have to do everything your parents say, and you don't have to believe everything your parents believe. Because most likely you're smarter than them.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. As Amy mentioned, one of the most conservative communities in Utah, and that's who they hire to teach chemistry. You think that's not occurring in your leafy enclave around Chicagoland?
Well, besides Trump bashing Trump and telling the kids don't listen to your parents because they're dumb. She also is pushing the vaccine.
We'll just keep getting Delta. We'll just keep getting variants over and over and over until people get vaccinated. It's never going to end. Exactly. It could end in 5 seconds if people would get vaccinated.
Yeah, I have to be here.
You're putting my family at risk because all of you are super spreaders. That's how teachers have felt all along about the kids, that the kids are going to kill them or kill one of their family members. And this psychosis still exists.
You know what?
I mean, Jesse Sharkey yesterday, real quick, said that they do not want to go back to school. They've reached impasse. Well, but hear me out real quick. Because if your kids are vaccinated and they come in contact with someone who has it, they want that child to be to quarantine. That means we wouldn't have any school. That means we wouldn't have any sports or any activities whatsoever. Because there's somebody put it in their heads that kids are killing them. And they're not.
Yeah, okay. I mean, CPS. CPS is like talking about Chicago violence. Is there anything left to say?
Well, I'm just thinking. That is their point of contention. Yeah, there's stuff to say because kids' lives are on the line here.
Yeah. Well, kids' lives are on the line every day in the streets of Chicago. Is there anything left to say about it? It's exhausting. So? That's where it's at. Who wants to do something about it? Who wants to pull their kids out of the government schools? Who wants to take on the teachers' unions? Nobody.
Well, they should take on this teacher because she wasn't done yet, Dan.
If you don't believe in climate change,
climate change,
get the hell out.
I'll be dead.
Okay. that's pathetic that you think that. You're the problem with the world. Okay. If you're a homophobe, get out.
Thank you.
Because I am the GSA faculty advisor. I love gay people. All LGBTQIA plus, mother. If you don't like it, get out. If I hear you say a damn word against any of them, I will open a can. And I will make your life a living hell. And they know it. If you say shiz to any
LGBTQ kid in the school, I will hear about it, and you will be in trouble.
This woman, she's psychotic.
You know who else said, if you don't like it, get out? Loyola Academy in Wilmette. That was essentially the position they took when it came to their racist curriculum they call critical race theory, which is just teaching racism. Loyola Academy in Wilmette, same position as her. Just, you know, more buttoned down about it, but it's the same position. You know, it's funny. When we talk about police, let's talk about self-policing, the thin blue line, the you know, police protecting other police, protecting bad actors on the police force. And sometimes that happens. What about teachers?
Yeah, there's a lot of bad teachers out there.
Do teachers have a responsibility to self-police? You think that this Lehigh, Utah chemistry teacher, you think this was her first excited utterance on any of the topics you just heard her cover? What does she say in the faculty lounge? What feedback do you hear from your students about other teachers? And what do you do about it? How about teacher self-policing? Are you there to reinforce the stated mission of most of these schools, the unifying values, the community norms, if you will, parents' viewpoints, at least consideration for, or is it just going to be a totalitarian re-education camp like this chemistry teacher who now, and only because some student videoed it and it got out, has been apparently relieved of her duties?
Thank God. But this whole, like, this is my classroom, I can say what I want, that pisses me off because it's the taxpayer's classroom, and she needs to be reminded that she's hired help. And I say that because we're teachers, yes, we are hired help. I'm hired help here, whatever. It's not her place.
There are some parents pushing back, and I know there's some parents doing it here around the state in pockets. Missouri. Two employees of Missouri's largest school district suing the district over unconstitutional, quote-unquote, equity training. The lawsuit centers around the purported experiences of a process coordinator focused on advocating for students with disabilities and a record secretary during training sessions last fall. They were berated for disagreeing with the content and the racist instruction. She had one, it claims in the suit, she had to affirm statements she disagreed with in order to progress in the mandatory training. Mandatory training and mandatory viewpoint inculcation. Mandatory positions that you must take in order to complete the mandatory training. That's the Springfield Public Schools in Missouri. A couple of employees there are suing. Well, that's the same thing going on with your kids in schools. And it's not limited to Lehigh, Utah, is it?
District 200, your school district, Wheaton, last night.
Not my school district. Well, I didn't go to public school.
Okay, well, where you lived, but still have friends and family there. And the thing is that, you know, originally the school board voted to make masks optional. And now because of Governor Pritzker's mandate, that's been reversed. And they talked about it last night. Here's Emma Woodhouse. She's on Twitter.
I have a PhD in educational psychology. I can't stand credentialism, but I think it's relevant because I've worked with hundreds of schools and been in thousands of classrooms. The forced covering of a child's face as a condition of in-person schooling is wrong. It's even more wrong when it's unlawfully dictated by a tyrannical governor who, motivated by politics, brazenly declares a public health emergency for schools, usurps the lawful authority of the local school board that has been established by the Illinois General Assembly and dictates what students wear to school. He doesn't have the authority to tell students what the dress code is. The legislative branch does. There's two statutes about it. You do, because your dress code comes from those statutes. But he can't tell students what to wear to school. So you're going to have a problem pretty quickly when it comes to enforceability. And in fact, and this is, I say this in love, I'm trying to speak truth, but also be just reasonable, because your current policy about face coverings is outdated from last year. It's unenforceable. In fact, it's in conflict with things that you said tonight. Your current policy says that people can remove their mask if they're having difficulty breathing. I'm having difficulty breathing right now, so I'm taking off my mask.
Please put your mask back on.
It says it in your policy.
They're 40 feet away.
You need to change your policy. And if you want to enforce a dress code on kids, you better change your dress code policy. Change it, because you know why? In Illinois, we can make religious objections to dress code policies.
Because of Emma.
Thank you.
Suspending the meeting, because while she was talking about it, and in their policy it says if you can't breathe, you can take your mask off. And that's what she did. And they got their panties in a bunch and suspended the meeting because of that.
Mm-hmm.
And they're standing 40, 50 feet away from her. They're nowhere near her.
Mm-hmm. There was another woman at that meeting who was escorted out by police because she didn't have her mask over her nose.
Oh my God.
Escorted out by police. This woman's son who was escorted out, yeah, I'm told, is in a wheelchair because of an adverse reaction to the vaccine shot. When she was escorted out by police, people clapped at that meeting at Wheaton Warrenville 200.
No, please tell me, dear God.
You just heard the response to Emma Woodhouse. Pretty muted. So why is this happening? Because 2/3 of Americans support state and local mask mandates, because 70% of Chicagoans do, because of these pee hats, men and women, these cardboard cutout men and women without chests in your community that you've allowed to take over the schools and everything else, including in Wheaton. And let me tell you something. For all of those who think that there's going to be some sort of, I hate to rain on people's parade, there's some sort of resurgence coming because Trump's off the ballot and Pritzker and blah, 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 blah. Some sort of opposition party forming. Wheaton. If you're
not our last hope,
hammering it in Wheaton as a conservative, then there is no place left to run north of I-80, at least in this state. I know a little something about Wheaton. No place. So that's where it's actually at. And if you think you can bitch about taxes and that's your path back in the face of this sort of sentimental barbarism at Wheaton Warrenville School District 200, then, you keep howling at the moon all you like. District 214, you think this is in Lehi, Utah? District 214, the plague of women vipers up there, hosting a community speaker series. Daniel Hill, the founding pastor of River City Church in Humboldt Park, author of White Awake and White Lies. Oh, it's a great two-book series. Joined for a conversation, obviously, about race and identity. Buffalo Grove High School is where that'll be held.
I'll be sure to miss it.
Well, yeah.
He wrote his thing, as a white pastor in Chicago, Daniel Hill has wrestled with what it means for him to be white and how that affects his leadership and ministry in Chicago.
Yeah, so you're going to
go. We should all just go attack.
You're going to go and apologize for being white and you spend all your time talking about how you have to atone for being born a particular skin color.
While he's making money off of white people who hired him to speak about white guilt.
So Buffalo Grove High School, District 214. You have teachers there. I don't know who they are. And this goes back to my self-policing, and I noticed I'm not getting much response on that. Oh, do teachers self-police? No, everybody else is supposed to self-police their profession. But teachers and government school systems, they're sacrosanct. None of the other standards of which we organize our free society have applied to K-12 government school systems for the last 60 years, and so we're here. And they're still not supposed to apply. So that chemistry teacher in Utah, that person is in District 214. That person is in District 200. That person is in every what you consider a good school district in every suburban community in Chicagoland. I'll bet you dollars to donuts. Mm-hmm. And the people in the school know it. And the parents know it. And they don't do anything about it.
Well, the kids could help out. If a teacher in District 214 goes on a rant like that teacher did in Lehi, Utah, they could record it.
Absolutely. Tina and Joliet.
Hi, good morning, guys.
Morning.
This is going to be
my weekly call to the show now. Just before I tell you my experience at the school board meeting, I plan on being at the League of Angry Housewives meeting in Buffalo Grove, and I will report back.
Oh, please do.
Whatever.
Can you get me a signed copy of White Lies?
We should try to get the pastor on the show. See why he's so guilty.
I'm going to do my best to get speaker car into the auditorium, but I'm not sure I'll be able to manage that one. But so end of July, there was a school board meeting in Joliet, and I don't even have kids in school anymore. I'm so incensed and disgusted with what I'm witnessing and just the apathy from the community. So I went to this school board meeting, and there was probably, I'd say, 35 parents there. At the beginning of the meeting, they had their roll call and their call to order, and they're kind of explaining, you know, what they're allocating monies for. And they have a paid consultant, an equity consultant, that they're paying $76,000 a year to teach teachers how to teach racism to children. And she stood up, gave her little presentation, fully masked. As she was leaving, there was a gentleman in the audience in his 70s. He's got 3 grandchildren in the school district. He stopped her politely and asked her if she would explain to him what equity means. She stared him dead in the eye and said, "Get a dictionary," and walked off. These people have nothing but contempt.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Contempt and disdain for those of us who are their lessers, and they are our betters, and we just need to do what we're told. That is the stance they've taken with the parents, with the taxpayers, with those of us who don't subscribe to their ridiculous, sickening ideology. I have zero faith in fixing this, quite frankly. And this is I finally come to that conclusion that we can't fix it.
Thanks.
We've got to leave it alone and let it destroy itself and find a different way.
Thanks, Tina.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. The Biden administration needs to tighten up the scripts because Clinton Foundation donor Zero was having a hard time getting the answer, the proper answer from Joe Biden to the simple question of will American forces remain in Afghanistan unless and until all Americans and, I would add, Afghan allies, I don't think Stephanopoulos did, are safely extracted.
Even if Americans and our Afghan allies are still trying to get out, they're going to leave?
No, he did mention.
We're going to do everything in our power to get all Americans out and our allies out.
Does that mean troops will stay beyond August 31st if necessary?
It depends on where we are and whether we can ramp these numbers up to 5,000 to 7,000 a day coming out. If that's the case, they'll all be out.
Because we've got like 10,000 to 15,000 Americans in the country right now, right? And are you committed to making sure that the troops stay until every American who wants to be out is out?
Yes.
How about our Afghan allies? We have about 80,000 people.
Well, that's not the
estimate. Is that too high?
That's too high.
How many?
The estimate we're giving is somewhere between 50 and 65,000 folks total, counting their families.
Does the commitment hold for them as well?
The commitment holds to get everyone out that, in fact, we can get out and everyone should come out.
Oh my God. There's a big difference between 10 and 15,000 Americans.
Here's what you're supposed to say when the question is, are we going to keep our promises? One, the explicit promise to American citizens everywhere all the time, and the specific promise to our Afghan allies. And the answer to that question should be yes, and then you should act in furtherance of the affirmative answer.
You say, heck yes, of course. We are not going to leave until every American is out of Afghanistan. But you don't see that kind of conviction with him.
Stephanopoulos sort of finally got him into the corner where he, I'm supposed to say yes, yes, and then he immediately backtracked and qualified that yes. I understand why he would qualify that yes, because his senior military leadership is doing the same. Milley and Austin, their briefing yesterday on the same question. First Milley, then Austin.
How can the U.S., the Pentagon, live up to that task of evacuating all Americans? Because we continue to see the violence just outside the airport. And how would you get them in, around the country unless you go get them?
Well, two things, Barbara. One is State Department, as you know, as I've said, is working with the Taliban to facilitate safe passage of American citizens, U.S. passport holders, to the airport. And that's the primary means, and under the current conditions, that's the primary effort. We have capability to do other things if necessary.
Well, can I ask you what that means? Because you also said there were international special forces there that have a capability to extract, and those words suggest very clearly in the military realm you would go get people.
Well, that would be a policy decision, and if directed, we have capabilities that can execute whatever we're directed.
Thank you.
Louis.
And I would draw a distinction, Barb, between extracting someone in an in extremis condition or circumstance versus going out and collecting up large numbers of American citizens.
Do you have the capability to go out and collect Americans?
We don't have the capability to go out and collect up large numbers of people, Barb.
That was some briefing. I'm left with a lot more questions
down
than the D.C. press corps asked, and I'm amazed, especially when we're scrambling 4,000 troops to help with the extraction, that there's talk of international special forces. There's talk of Taliban safe passage. And the reports are not only there's chaos around the airport, difficulty for a lot of people to get to the airport. Yes, that the Taliban is offering some safe passage, but it's described this way by the Wall Street Journal. Despite intense Taliban checkpoints and random beatings, U.S. military transport planes are landing at the Kabul airport and departing with Americans, other Western nationals, and a smattering of Afghans. But the question is, what happens and what is the contingency planning? Because you've demonstrated you're not particularly adroit at contingency planning if that situation deteriorates. If the Taliban decides to change its position, we're relying on the goodwill of the Taliban to make sure we extract all of those Americans and all of those Afghan allies. And I'd also like to know from Biden, do you even really know? I mean, are we working off manifests of American citizens on the ground and Afghan allies to make sure that everybody is accounted for and everybody who should be extracted is?
I mean, basically, we're begging the Taliban to save Americans. That's what this is.
Yeah. John Hayward is the National Security Deputy Editor at Breitbart News. John, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Your general comment on the moral and policy imperative right now, which is getting Americans and Afghan allies out of Afghanistan.
Well, that certainly is the imperative. This whole thing was bungled beyond belief. I mean, this is the worst disaster, I think, maybe in American history. I'm at a loss to think of anything that was more disastrous, more poorly planned, more calamitous. We're reduced to this $1 trillion military, $1 trillion spent in Afghanistan, $1 trillion military budget. And Biden's Joint Chiefs guy is up there saying, oh, we can't do anything. We have no capability. Sorry. We have no capabilities at all. We're helpless. All we can do is plead with the Taliban. Please don't kill our people. Please let them come to the airport. You promised you'd let them come to the airport. The Taliban is not doing that. We have confirmed reports from across Kabul of the Taliban setting up checkpoints, beating people with whips and chains, firing guns at them, keeping them from getting to the airport. So they clearly aren't keeping any promise that they made to let people in there. And they're not going to keep that promise. And honestly, I think the best thing we have going for us right now, the best hope we have that this doesn't turn into a bloodbath or a gigantic Jimmy Carter hostage situation that goes on for years, is that the Taliban is getting a lot of political advice from China. That's their new partner. And the Chinese are telling them, don't do that or it will topple the Biden presidency. And we like him right where he is. Wow. The enemies of America very much want Joe Biden to stay there. They don't want this administration to come down. This is a bonanza for them. It's a field day. Why would they want Joe Biden to go anywhere? So the Chinese are going to be advising the Taliban, yeah, kill a bunch of the Afghans. You know, what are they going to do? But don't kill the Americans. Let them go, you know, because we don't want to bring Biden down. We need him there.
But America, I mean, the Secretary of Defense, they don't have their Americans back. I mean, what you want to hear is we will get them out at no matter what cost. We will save our Americans that are over there. Do you know how many people, how many, is it 10,000? Is it 15,000? How many U.S. citizens with passports are there?
I've heard estimates much higher than that. I don't think the Biden administration knows what it's doing in any respect, so I wouldn't credit any of their numbers or estimates. I have heard 40,000 kicked around as the real number. I think it's much higher than the number that they're saying it is. The Biden State Department, by the way, day before yesterday, they sent a message out to every American in Afghanistan that said, you're on your own. We can't help you.
Get to the airport.
If you can get to the airport, yep, get to the airport, but your life's in your hands. You know, that has to be the nadir, I think, of American power and prestige in our entire existence. I think that's the low point.
The Biden
administration sending a text message to people and saying, hey, you're dead. We can't help you. Just get to the airport, please. You know, do what you can.
It's stunning. It's stunning. Some of the pronouncements from Jake Sullivan, National Security Advisor, as well as Milley in Austin yesterday. And this idea, you're here we go again, signaling. You're telling the Taliban, we don't have the capacity to do mass extractions. It's first come, first serve at the airport. So you're indicating to them our limitations, and it's really a self-imposed limitation because it's not a resource limitation. It's a I don't know what it is. It's a self-imposed moral or policy limitation that we will deploy what the resources that need to be deployed to pull people out of the neighborhoods where they're stranded or wherever else they are, and we'll bring hell with us as needed.
And there's some grousing from the British troops that are deployed there, that the American troops have apparently been ordered to stay tightly inside the airport. They won't go outside it. They won't help anybody outside it. The British are sending paratroop units out there to try to bring people in. The Americans won't do that. They're under orders not to. So I think there's a real sense here that they don't want to step over that line they've drawn around the airport, or that could escalate, become a, you know, a big war with the Taliban that Biden doesn't want. So it's a policy constraint. Capability-wise, I'm sure we have plenty of weapons.
Sorry, but there was another airport that they could have used, the Bagram Air Force Base, that they closed. Why would they do that? They could have gotten all the Americans out if they kept that place open.
That is really baffling. A lot of people that are veterans of Afghanistan that have been commenting on this have just been scratching their heads in disbelief that anybody let Biden do that, that was just calamitous to let Bagram go. That would have been a much better place to conduct this evacuation from than Kabul. It's baffling. It's almost incomprehensible. Why did he do that? And the only real answer, I guess, is that, you know, Biden is, he's not a smart man. He's never been a smart man before he started losing his mental faculties. But he's very, very insistent that he's a genius. He will tell anybody who listens that he knows everything. So he apparently, according to the leaks we're getting, he ignored all kinds of input from the military, from the intelligence apparatus. Everybody involved in Afghanistan is now saying, we were telling him, don't do this. Don't let Bagram go. Don't do this plan. And Biden ignored them and said, no, I know best. I'm Joe Biden. I'm going to do this. I see no alternative explanation.
He wants to keep his perfect record intact, as Bob Gates, former DOD CIA, said. Hasn't been right about one foreign policy matter in about 20 years, maybe longer, and that stays intact. With respect to the Americans, I think a lot of people are surprised to hear the number, potential number, the range of numbers of Americans who are in Afghanistan. What's your sense of the composition of that cohort, the Americans in Afghanistan? Who are these Americans?
Well, according to Joe Biden, they're idiots. He called them stupid and said they should have left sooner. And why are they even there? He's complaining that they're there and he has to worry about them now. But why wouldn't they have stayed there? A month ago, Joe Biden was telling them there was no way the Taliban could take over the country, that the huge and well-equipped Afghan military would easily destroy the Taliban when they tried to descend from the northern provinces. So there was no reason to worry. And even once that wasn't true and the Taliban was taking city after city after city in this blitzkrieg as they swept across the country, Joe Biden was out there saying, oh, it'll take 90 days, 6 months. Kabul will hold out for a long time. He was telling everybody that would listen that they had all kinds of time to do whatever was necessary. Now, I would assume most of the people still in Afghanistan are not tourists. You know, they probably have some kind of job. They're probably contractors.
Right.
A lot of them would have worked with the Afghan civilian government. So I don't think they're just, you know, they're not there because they had 2 days left on their hotel package and didn't want to let it go. They're there for a reason.
Yeah, right.
And the fact that they're not near the airport, I think, would then begin to tell you something of what they were doing. They were involved in industry. They weren't necessarily directly involved with the Afghan government because of where the airport's located. So, I mean, these are people that had jobs and reasons to be there, and they didn't think this was going to happen. Nobody thought the Taliban was going to sweep into Kabul overnight, and that is a massive intelligence failure. This is partially, again, Biden's fault because the leaks are now saying he was told this could happen and he ignored them. But also, how could our intelligence people, our massive intelligence military community, how did they not know that the Taliban was quietly arranging a string of surrenders from northern Afghanistan all the way to Kabul in a straight line that would take only a week? It would have taken them months to negotiate those deals, and we had no idea they were doing it.
He is John Hayward, Breitbart News National Security Deputy Editor. John, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Here's what Florida Governor Ron DeSantis had to say about COVIDian mask mandating politicos, state and local, federal, state and local for that matter.
Politicians want to force you to cover your face as a way for them to cover their own asses. That's just the truth.
Oh, hello.
Yeah.
Whoa. Yeah.
I like the unfiltered truth from Ron DeSantis. He's one of the few offering it that's in elective office in this country, sorry to say. And with respect to the mask mandates, he's fighting the fight in Florida. Now, of course, it's the reverse of the fight here. You have some school districts bucking his prohibition on mask mandates, and he started to impose fines. And then, so what do you have? The Department of Education, Federal Department of Education, comes in and says, oh, we'll pay the superintendent's salaries who don't get paid. Oh, really?
So we've
got a federal bailout of states where their constituents, the administration's constituents, are adversely impacted by their own decisions. That's completely a state and local matter. It's just remarkable they come over the top. Now, compare that to what Governor Ducey is doing in Arizona. He is providing relief for K-12 students and families, more relief. Fund up to $7,000 per student for needs related to child care, transportation, online tutoring, and tuition to keep all kids on track, close the achievement gap, you know, and so on and so forth. Provide more, essentially, school choice-oriented resources to families to chart the best course for educating their children as opposed to just being captive to the teachers' unions-run totalitarian re-education camps, as we were describing a little bit last hour. So we saw Timothy Christian, the superintendent there, make an announcement that after much consideration, they came to this decision in consultation with families in their school in Elmhurst that it would be mask optional. Then this is and they decided to stick with it even after the governor's edict because they had made the decision based on reasonable consideration and consultation with the parents. So just because a politician says something different under dubious legal authority, we're not going to change what we're going to do, what we believe is in the best interest of our students and families. And then they were threatened with loss of accreditation and
no sports,
and diploma loss of
means nothing.
Taxpayer credit, taxpayer credit scholarship funding. And they immediately folded, Matt Davidson.
But there's 21 districts in this state, and I know there's a lot of school districts here, but 21 have said, no, we're not going to follow the mandate. We're going to follow the recommendation by the CDC, and that's what we're going to do, to make masks optional.
Well, that's 21 out of 800, so that's not terribly encouraging.
No, those aren't good.
Even more discouraging has been the response from private schools, particularly faith-based schools. Where was the rally around Timothy Christian? Where was Timothy Christian holding fast and then the rally around them? You know, I've said before, Christian and Catholic schools, why are they not coming together and adopting the NATO posture. An attack on one is an attack on all. You're going to really, you're going to remove the accreditation and you're not going to allow St. Ignatius and Mount Carmel to play sports. I'd like to see that. I'd like to see.
That would be entertaining.
I'd like to see Pritzker attempt that. He wouldn't. But that requires, again, you use clout to protect kids rather than just protecting your clout. And unfortunately, that's what a lot of Catholic and Christian schools and their financiers have done. But it doesn't seem to be the case at Families of Faith Christian Academy in Shanahan. Randy Bland is the headmaster there, and he joins us now. Randy, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. How are you guys?
Good. So I understand you've seen a nice little explosion in your enrollment there at Families of Faith in Shanahan. So congratulations on that. And after much consideration and against the backdrop of Governor Pritzker's mask mandate, what is it that Families of Faith is going to do with respect to in-person education?
Well, listen, I thank you for allowing me to be on your program today. And I just want to say that it's a great day in Shanahan, at least for us. Our school year starts in less than an hour, and our families and our students are excited to get back under a completely normal set of circumstances. Clearly, you know, our government has failed our families. We started this school 16 years ago because we saw the degrading of our family values that this nation was founded on. We saw families in trouble, and God has blessed us with an amazing, you know, facility. And I'll be honest, I don't have the ability, nor do I have any desire just to walk away from what I believe God's called me to. We're called to stand in the gap for these families. And listen, we are firmly entrenched in that commitment to that call. You know, we have no intention or desire, you know, to take those liberties or those freedoms or choices away from our families. And we're going to operate as normal. We're going to do everything we did last year, and we're going to continue, you know, just to let our children come into our facilities and see each other's faces, play with each other, and just have normal of a lifestyle as we can possibly give them.
And you did this last year, too? There weren't mask mandates?
No, we did this last year as well. In fact, our governor sued us for that, and we went to court 5 times in Springfield. You know, there was never any consequence. There was never anything that came. We didn't even get a letter, you know, acknowledging that there was an issue. And so we have a guard that's posted on our parking lot. If you're not a part of our school, if you're not, you know, there for an appointment, you're not welcome on the property and you're not allowed in the building. If our governor or anyone else wants to speak to me, they can see me after school at 4 o'clock, and, you know, I'll talk to them about what we're doing and, you know, what we plan to do going forward.
Well, what happened with the litigation? I mean, is it over?
It's over. Okay. I mean, nothing happened. What happened was Bailey sued him, right, and won in Clay County, and they were just looking for, you know, a pawn to get some sort of victory in another jurisdiction so then they could take that to, you know, an appeals court to try to empower him even more than he feels he already is. And I think that if that's really all that was about, I don't think our governor cares if kids are in school or not in school. I don't think he cares if they wear masks or not. I think that he has a completely different agenda, and it's becoming more obvious as we go through this. But for me, I just want to see our families and our students have the opportunity to learn. The last 18 months has been devastating, mm-hmm, you know, to our kids and families, and we're seeing the product of that as they come into our school. Imagine a kindergartner, you know, that didn't finish kindergarten, you know, 2 years ago is now going into second grade after a year of e-learning. They're not prepared for second grade. You know, they're talking about how many people have died from COVID, and I understand it's heartbreaking. But I'm going to be honest, I did a lot of funerals last year, actually the last 18 months, and I haven't buried one person with COVID, but I did bury a lot of people, you know, who committed suicide. And so this is destroying families. It's destroying our nation, and people got to stand up. You know, I heard you, Dan, say something about the Christian church is not rallying together, you know, for these schools. That breaks my heart. I mean, God called us to be the frontline workers. He called us to be the example. We're supposed to be the one, you know, that shares the light of Christ, that shows the hope that's in this world. And too many churches and too many Christian organizations have folded their hand and took a seat in the back of the line. You know, and unfortunately, that's not who God's called us to be.
Well, what happens if you haven't already, if you get a threatening letter from IHSA or the Illinois State Board of Education or funds that go to students through the tax taxpayer credit scholarship fund are removed by the state, or there's an attempt to remove them, then what do you do?
Well, the families that are suffering, I'll be honest, we have a huge scholarship program. Our school, you know, underwrites a lot of these kids. We're not turning kids away. We're not here, you know, to make money. If parents are struggling financially, we're going to do what we can to help them. If I get a letter from the state, you know, I'm just going to assume it's a form letter because nobody called me, and I'll probably just throw it away. I'm not concerned about their threats. I have a whole lot more fear, you know, for my God than I do anybody else in this world. And so I'm going to do what I'm called to do, regardless of what anyone says.
What have your conversations been, if you've had any, with other Christian schools, principals, headmasters, school board members, Christian and Catholic schools in the area or in the state about all of this?
I've had public schools and private schools alike call me and ask me if I could give them some advice on, you know, how to stay open with no mask mandates. And I shared a lot of things with these schools, and I was encouraged and I was hopeful. In fact, one particular school called and asked, you know, what can you do? We're having a board meeting tonight. Can you give me any advice what to say? I said, sure. I said, did you guys get a letter in the mail? Did you get a phone call? Did anybody show up and tell you that this was what you were supposed to do? And he said, well, not to my knowledge. I said, so you're going to allow your school to make policy based on a new news broadcast that you saw on CNN or some other station? You're going to allow that to happen? That makes sense to you? And the guy said, no, not really. I said, then why don't you just go do, you know, what you believe you ought to do and let the chips fall where they may, until somebody knocks on your door and says, this is what you have to do. You know, don't fight that fight until you have to, you know? And so he thought that was a great idea. He called me back and said, you know what, we're just going to do it. 2 days later, the state comes out and says, if you do this, you're going to lose your recognition. He called me back and said, listen, we folded our hand. And it's heartbreaking. It's like, you know, why don't you just take a stand for what you believe? You know, that's the most disheartening thing for me, is watching these people just get in lockstep with all this nonsense and not have any conviction, you know, because our kids are paying for this. You know, I'm a father of five, and I'm working on adopting another one right now. And the last thing I would ever allow is the government to come into my home and tell me how to raise my kids, you know, or what's going to happen to them in any way whatsoever. I have no appetite for that at all.
Well, so how were your numbers last year? I mean, did you have to close down or do any remote learning?
No, not at all. Good. No, it was 100% completely normal. In fact, what we did is, as soon as school was out, we had already contracted with a company, and we had a carnival in our parking lot at our school, the first one in our area. 30,000 people showed up to that carnival in 4 days. You know, and nobody wore masks. Nobody, I mean, they were shoulder to shoulder. They had an amazing time. We didn't have any outbreaks in our school at all from COVID. You know, I closed our church down, you know, for the first 2 or 3 weeks for fear, you know, that there was something serious going on. But we immediately opened back up. We've never had an outbreak in our church. People are singing. They're standing shoulder to shoulder. They're involved in all kinds of ministries, you know, and we just didn't see, you know, the evidence, you know, of the severity of this that we were being told day after day by congregating together. We know that it's serious. We know that people lost their lives and their loved ones, but we didn't see the impact that they were telling us it was going to have. You know, we believe in herd immunity. We believe, you know, in common sense. If you're sick, stay home. If there's something wrong with you, don't come to school. You know, and our parents and our students, you know, have done that. We had the healthiest year ever, you know, in our history of 16 years last year. You know, I mean, we really did. I mean, typically we would send kids home, you know, for flu or for sicknesses. Last year we had the healthiest year ever. It was amazing. Of course, we believe that was God's blessing on us.
Well, it's amazing. I mean, Shanahan is an hour and a half south of Chicago, and it might as well be on the other end of the earth, I think, for most people in Chicago metro. But it's
carnival you speak of? I don't know what.
Well, it's such an example, though. It's right here, and it's such an example. counterexample to what 99% of people are doing. As you mentioned, Amy, there's a couple dozen other school districts that are sticking with mask optional. We'll see what happens to them. But wow, that's really refreshing, Randy. And I hope you decide to franchise your Families of Faith Christian Academy, because I think there will be increased demand, not just in the Shanahan area, but around the country with what's happening right now in K-12 education. Randy Bland, headmaster.
Well, I appreciate that, Dan. You know, I just want to say that we are starting another school in Romeoville next year.
Good.
And we made that commitment all the way back. I mean, we've been working with this church in Romeoville for the last probably eight or nine months, and we've worked through all the paperwork. We actually signed a contract with them in July, even before these mandates, you know, came out, because we see the need, you know, for private education. I mean, it's evident through these kinds, you know, of mandates and this kind of attitude towards education and children. There's a great need for this, and we need to see more of it. So next fall, we'll be opening up another academy in Romeoville.
That's awesome. Taking more students, also taking more family members. So can people apply to be adopted by you as well, or?
You know what? Listen, I absolutely believe that God has given us, you know, a great facility, and he's given us the ability to, you know, to do all we can to help these kids. And we don't want to turn any of them away. We want to find ways, you know, to bring them into our school, whether they can afford it or not. And, you know, so far we've been blessed to be able to do that.
Randy Bland, headmaster, Families of Faith Christian Academy. Randy, thanks so much for joining us. Continued success.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to talk with you guys.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Let's hear from former U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan in the Obama administration, Ryan Crocker, again. I want to play this clip of him again, because this is prior to that middling interview that Biden did yesterday with Clinton Foundation donor Zero, where he struggled, just as his NSA did, Jake Sullivan, to make a commitment that U.S. military would remain in Afghanistan until all Americans and American allies, Afghan allies of America, are extracted. This is Ryan Crocker's assessment of the Biden response, the Biden contingency planning prior to that.
I very much feel that way. This is his first major test as commander-in-chief. It has not gone well, to say the very least. I think I was most affected by his remarks of yesterday. He was unapologetic. He was defiant. He quoted the famous adage from Harry Truman, "The buck stops here," and then proceeded to blame everybody else, most significantly, of course, the Afghan National Security Forces.
Mm-hmm. And then yesterday with Stephanopoulos, he sort of continued on that line when Stephanopoulos asked pro forma, no pushback, of course, because it's a softball interview set up. They're each reading from their scripts, or they're supposed to be. At least that's how the handlers had it planned. Could anything have gone better? No, not really. It was inevitable that it would be chaos. For more on this and a couple of other topics, please be joined again by Dave Seminara, former diplomat, author of Footsteps of Federer and Mad Travelers, A Tale of Wanderlust, Greed, and the Quest to Reach the Ends of the Earth. Dave, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me back on the show, Dan. How's your summer going?
It's good. By the way, I didn't know how much we had in common. You have an honorary doctorate in Icelandic folk dancing from Fresno State.
Yes, I do.
I majored in Icelandic folk dancing at Northwestern.
But he got a B. Oh,
it's weird how, you know, we've been living these parallel lives. I know your diplomatic career did not include stints in Central Asia. But you know, as a former...
I've been to Central Asia, though. I've been to several of the stands, though. Not Afghanistan, but I've been to Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan. I've been to several of them.
Well, give us your perspective then, as somebody who's traveled to the region and is also as a Foreign Service officer on what you've seen the last 4 days.
Well, let's just say, first of all, I did stint as a consular officer, as a Foreign Service officer, and consular officers are in charge of evacuation. So this is something that I did not engage in any evacuations, fortunately. However, the first post that I served in Macedonia, they had actually done an American citizen evacuation a year before I'd gotten there. There was a civil war there in 2001, and I arrived in 2002. So this was all sort of fresh. Fresh when I'd gotten there. There had been an evacuation of U.S. citizens in the country 6 months or so before I'd gotten there. And I've gone through the State Department's courses on evacuations of U.S. citizens. So I've actually been following this fairly closely. And the first thing that struck me was the images of that military aircraft with anywhere between 640 and 800 some odd Afghans crammed onto this plane. This is the first thing that struck me is, wait a minute, why are we engaging in the evacuation of any Afghan citizens whatsoever? And I understand some of them, if they were translators or they work with us, great. We're going to evacuate them at some point. But every U.S. citizen should be prioritized first. I mean, I during our training, I never even heard of us evacuating foreign citizens from their own country, especially before American citizens were evacuated. We still have reportedly several thousand U.S. citizens who are in Afghanistan and some of these Afghans forced their way onto this plane, apparently, is that what happened was that we weren't intending to take 640 or 800 of them or how many ever crammed onto that plane, but some of them just forced their way in, basically, to the aircraft. So, like, the complete chaos of the evacuation is absolutely shocking and appalling and disgusting to me. And I'm in utter disbelief that it could have gone this way, because absolutely foreseeable. I mean, this is not like Switzerland, where all of a sudden some terrible natural disaster occurred and we have to, do an evacuation of U.S. citizens in Switzerland. And oh my gosh, we weren't expecting this at all, right? I mean, I don't really know what else to say, but it's just an incredible scene of chaos, and we look like the third world country here.
And respond to the cover story, because the cover story from Chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff's Milley yesterday and from Biden and others in the press corps that are running interference for them, no one could have known. The intelligence estimates may be a month, maybe a year, so on and so forth. But that's a mischaracterization of the intelligence estimates that continue to paint a more dire picture as we got closer to what transpired over the weekend. So that's disingenuous. But also, and then the understanding of what was, more or less likely, and the contingency planning that should have been done regardless of whether what transpired this weekend did or not. But just the diplomatic speak you're hearing from politicians, including politicians in uniforms.
Right. And they're all trying to cover their asses right now. I mean, I heard a clip this morning of Linda Thomas Greenfield, who is our ambassador, U.S. ambassador to the U.N., saying that we issued a very strongly worded statement warning the Taliban not to mistreat women and so on and so forth. Oh, my goodness. Well, if we are issuing strongly worded press statements, then everything's just going to be fine, isn't it?
Yeah.
This whole situation is incredible. I mean, it really, even by the low standards of the Biden administration efficiency, I really can't believe that they botched this badly. And at this point, it's really critical to figure out where do we go from here. And for me, the first, and most important thing is really figuring out how to get our U.S. citizens out of the country. I mean, I read also that we've apparently sent warden messages to U.S. citizens in Afghanistan saying it's up to them to figure out how to get to the airport. Good luck, guys, getting to the airport. If you get to the airport, maybe we're going to help you. That is not good enough. I mean, listen, most of these, many of these U.S. citizens, I would say, who are in Afghanistan are people who are like security contractors. I mean, a lot of these people are people who have previously served in our armed forces, who have many of them, high percentage of them, are people who have risked their lives, for our country. And just to say, well, good luck, you can figure out how to get to the airport, we're going to help you. That is not good enough. After we've already spent trillions of dollars in Afghanistan, and how many lives we've lost, 2,400 of our men and women and such, this is not good enough. It's time to go the extra mile to safely get our citizens out of Afghanistan. Well, and, whatever they've botched up until this time point, they should right now be focusing on that singular goal, not worrying about at the moment, translators or bringing in thousands of refugees or all these other things they're talking about, the singular focus right now should be trying to figure out how to safely get our citizens out of the country.
Yeah, there's absolutely no sense of urgency when you listen to any of those, our politicians yesterday and the, you know, Secretary of Defense. But they stand a chance. They could get kidnapped or killed. That's also a possibility. They're sitting ducks right now.
It's incredible. And I also, I'm also shocked, too, by the way, that they were even planning to do the evacuation out of the Kabul airport. The plan should have all along been Bagram Air Force Base. And to have abandoned this place, now, I mean, the amount of equipment that we have abandoned, too, which will now be taken up by the Taliban and, you know, could be used against us or could fall into the hands of enemies, of terrorists. And the whole thing is shocking. It's, and if this isn't, I mean, at the moment, it's not time for investigations and such. It's time for us to pick up the pieces and to move on. But we also, at some point later on, this is, all of this should be investigated. And the people in the U.S. government who are responsible for this fiasco have to lose their jobs. There have to be consequences for this.
I want to hear more about the training you do as a Foreign Service officer with civilian evacuations, evacuating Americans from a particular place that you know, where that has gone haywire, as Afghanistan did, as Kabul did. And so what is that? I mean, other than this, the logistical decisions about, you know, Bagram Airport versus the airport in Kabul, what are other things you see that you say, well, or things you've heard say that is not consistent with how sort of standard operating procedure in these circumstances, including, as you were just describing, this idea that you have to make your way to the airport? Secretary of Defense Austin saying we don't have the capacity to do extraction of large numbers of people, only individual people in extreme positions.
Well, what I can tell you is, you know, all consular officers, you take a course called CONGEN, which is, I think it was like a 2-month long course, something like that. Of course, I took this course in 2002, so we're talking about 19 years ago. But of course, a lot of these things really don't change. What I will say is that I think that a lot of these evacuations are handled on a sort of ad hoc basis, in terms of not everything is done the same way at each time. It really depends upon the circumstances. But one thing that I can tell you for a fact, that is, in 2001 in Macedonia, which is, you know, comparing 2001 Macedonia to 2021 Afghanistan is, you know, really sort of no contest in terms of the danger level. However, I will say that at that time, we did, when I say we, I mean the U.S. government. I was not at the embassy, but this happened shortly before I got there. They did evacuate U.S. citizens from the country. And what they did was they actually chartered buses to actually go to people's homes and get them. So this was a much, you know, a much greater level of effort on the part of the U.S. government. Now, I will say that they did charge U.S. citizens for this. However, it was, you know, sort of a nominal fee. And it was very well organized by the embassy. And it wasn't just like, hey, we recommend you leave, good luck, adios, or whatever. It was, you know, this was a very serious and intensive effort to actually really help people. And it wasn't just like, hey, good luck, you know, if you get to the Skopje airport, we're going to help you. It was much more involved than that.
I just that statement of get to the airport. I mean, it's like, go to the Greyhound bus station and we'll have buses there waiting for you. You know, you come to us in a situation as dire as this is just staggering.
Right. Sorry, go ahead, Dan.
No, I mean, just in addition to what we heard from Jake Sullivan and again yesterday, Biden, the real resistance to make a commitment
to help us,
to send the signal to the Taliban that we are going to be there and we are going to do whatever it takes to get our people out. So you're on notice, rather than please, mother, may I?
Right. I was going to say, too, that if we can charter buses to bring people who have broken our laws and who have entered our country illegally, if we can charter buses to bring these people to Chicago and to wherever their final destinations of choice would be, you think maybe we could go the extra mile to safely evacuate American citizens from one of the most dangerous countries in the world at the moment? I don't know. It's very sad.
Speaking of immigration, you were recently in Ecuador. You wrote about it in a piece in City Journal, you know, part of your global travels. And you took away something from that trip, that experience, about economic migrants attempting to come to the United States.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, what we hear over and over again is that migrants are coming here, that they're fleeing violence and persecution, right? How many times, Dan and Amy, have you guys heard that one?
Yeah, right.
Right.
Does a day ever go by when you don't hear that? I mean, it's sort of...
Except if they're Cuban. Only if right. they're, no. except if they're
can't,
Cuban.
Can't have Cubans, they're Republicans.
The world of economic migrants does not exist for the Democratic Party and the left. And what they're trying to do is they want to, in order to extract the maximum amount of sympathy and to let in as many people as possible, they have to sort of embed this, brand this in the minds of the public, is that migrants come here fleeing violence and persecution. Well, there's one country, there's a number of them, but one that I just happen to have traveled to, where immigration, illegal immigration, is up 434% this year, year over year. So in the first 6 months of this year, more than 45,000 Ecuadorians. Now, remember, this is not a huge country. This is not like Mexico, which has, you know, nearly 200 million people. I think Ecuador has 16, 17 million people in that range. So, you know, 45,000 people being apprehended in 6 months at the border. Remember, those are just the ones we caught. And, you know, a lot of estimates say that maybe one out of every three illegal migrants are actually caught at the border. So the real figure here is more coming over. And I was just in Ecuador for 3 weeks, and I have to tell you, it's an absolutely beautiful country, and it's a relatively safe country. Crime rates in the major cities, I visited the three largest cities there, are comparatively lower. They're definitely lower than Chicago, and overall murder rates lower than the U.S. These people are coming here to make money, plain and simple. They're coming here because they can make more money here than there. And this is just, it's so readily apparent, and yet there's this coordinated effort on the part of both the media and the Democratic Party, which really work hand in hand as sort of communications wing, communications tag team, in order to sort of mislead and fool the American people into thinking that this is not economic migration. This is just people fleeing violence. And in many cases, you know, for every person who's fleeing violence, there's 20 people, 50 people, 100 people who are coming here for a much simpler reason. And that's just to either make money or to have a more generous, you know, essentially welfare system.
Yeah. And again, there's nothing wrong with that. We want people to come over here to better their lives. Completely understandable. But you make the point here, too, that those who do it illegally versus those who do it legally,
yeah.
It's just a different cross-section of the population of any country. And this yeah. is why the distinction between legal and illegal is another reason, I should say, why the distinction between legal and illegal immigration is so important.
Right. No, and I mean, I think I made the point in the article, too, that, you know, I've been to 70-some-odd countries. Ecuador is one of my very favorites. This is one of the best trips I've taken in my life. Ecuadorian people are some of my favorite in the world. Incredibly welcoming, incredibly nice. And I think where sometimes people on the right get it wrong is they try to really scare people about immigration. You know, the people who are coming here are, you know, like in Trump's famous comment about they're sending us rapists. Listen, the point is most of these people are very nice people. They're very good people. However, just because people are nice, that doesn't mean we can allow them to break our laws. You have to have a system of fairness. So my point about a lot of economic migrants is not to like sort of castigate them or to say they're awful, horrible people or we should be afraid of them because they're criminals and so on and so forth. But it's that it doesn't just being nice people and being good people and being hardworking people, that does not give them the right to break our laws. So I loved Ecuador. In fact, I already missed the place. I kind of wish I was back there. And one of the points I made in the article is that there's more than 10,000 Americans who have retired there. Now, the region yeah. in Ecuador called Cuenca, which sends us the most migrants, is one of the regions that sends us the most immigrants. You've got people coming the other way. It's also a very popular retirement destination for Americans. So how can you make the case, you know, that a place is too dangerous or awful when we've got Americans heading down in that direction? I mean, it really makes no sense.
No.
Same with Costa Rica.
Yeah, there are other places in Central America and South America, like Ecuador, where that's the case, too.
And Mexico, too.
Yeah, places like Venezuela, not among the list.
No.
But yes, there are some. Absolutely. Dave Seminara, former diplomat, author of Footsteps of Federer and Mad Travelers, A Tale of Wanderlust, Greed, and the Quest to Reach the Ends of the Earth. Dave, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Great talking to you guys. Have a good day.
Thanks, you too. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560. The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and we got lots of questions on a myriad of COVID topics, so let's get right to it. Dr. Jonathan Ellen, pediatrician, epidemiologist, CEO of Connections for Health, and former president and vice dean at Johns Hopkins All Children's Hospital, joins us again. Dr. Ellen, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning. I hope you're all well.
Thank you. Same. And I want to get your reaction to something that Muhammad Ali's daughter, Leila Ali, said. She said, I'm quoting her, "People don't seem to understand that just because some folks don't wear masks, they don't want the shot, they don't listen to the media or live in fear, it doesn't mean that they don't believe the virus is real or think they can't get it. They understand it presents a threat to, you know, human beings." Now, before you answer that question, remember, she also moves like a butterfly.
Moves like a butterfly, stings like a bee.
Exactly. Yes. I was about to butcher it. You saved me.
That's so, not like you, Dan.
So, yeah. I knew this stings like a bee. I was sure it moves like. So just remember that as you answer this question, because we're going to report back to Leila Aliyah in your answer.
Oh, no. So that's my answer to that? My answer to it is that there's a lot of people with opinions that don't represent political opinions and don't necessarily represent, they're not just standing on ground. They actually either A, have a different opinion. And I think that's part of one of our questions about how we communicate and the public health issue, which is there are people who just have different opinions. There are people who are legitimately scared of the vaccine. And there are people who are legitimately bothered by masks. And we, you know, you can argue about it, but it's differences of opinion and framework rather than some type of political statement. Mm-hmm. And there's a good chunk of people who that's where they fall.
Do you think this is a good approach, particularly for young people, if you even accept the premise that there's a moral imperative to get people 18 and younger vaccinated? Quinnipiac University in Connecticut will fine students up to $2,275 and block their internet access if they don't comply with the university's COVID policies.
It depends what the policies are. I think the issue of pushing vaccines is pretty strong at this point. But I don't know what, you know, these kind of monetary penalties seem to be overreach in this case.
Well, what about the mask mandates?
Yeah. You know, the mask.
And the old question, are masks effective, huh? Don't you love that question?
I hate
doctor?
That question. I'm going to give up my doctorate just to answer that question. But it is, there's two different points. Do I think it's probably prudent to, you know, if you're in an indoor direct setting where there's no ventilation to wear a mask, it's probably not a stupid idea. On the other hand, mandates themselves come with their own repercussions and pushback. And, you know, I think that I always react to the word mandate just in general. So, which doesn't mean I disagree. It's sort of the same thing about Ali's daughter. I don't disagree. I happen to actually think it's a good thing to wear a mask, but mandates, the word mandate just always sort of troubles me. Just does in general.
Well, I just feel like the need to raise this. We talked to Jeffrey Anderson, this statistician who looked at all of the studies, including the studies touted by the CDC and NIH to provide evidence that mask wearing is effective in reducing viral load, combating transmission. And 11 of the 14 random controlled trial studies found no evidence or even that they were counterproductive because of the nature of cloth masks, for example, or even the way surgical masks are generally worn. And the studies that the CDC cites, like guys like Dr. Francis Collins or Fauci, that are posted on their website, are observational studies. They're not randomly controlled trials.
Right. No, I think, and the problem we always have with these, and I think I've told you this before, but one of the problems with any study that's an observational study is that you never know what the cause and effect of direction is. So
right.
The problem is if someone's in a highly exposed situation and wears a mask, where like everyone's pushed together like sardines, and they wear a mask because that's the environment, they're more likely to get infected than in the environment where there's nobody crowding them and they don't wear a mask. So you're going to get the reverse. You're going to get the reverse finding. And I think observational studies are really problematic. I mean, they just are in this case. And I don't know if we have, you know, the RCTs have really demonstrated that masks are the best thing. I think
it to me, they're not a big deal, but I don't like the word mandate around.
Right, but what about the emotional and psychological effects that masks have on children, especially kindergarten, first grade? They don't know what normal is, and they're afraid to breathe the air. I mean, we've got put the fear of God in them so much that they're afraid to take their mask off because there's germs out there.
Well, I actually, I mean, my bigger issue is this whole idea of freaking kids out and what we're worrying about with kids and masks. And, you know, I know that, you know, right today there's a story in the New York Times going one direction against the article that was in the Wall Street Journal by, I guess, by McCary from Hopkins, saying it does stunt their learning and growth. And in the end, I just feel like, what are we getting so freaked out about in the schools? Schools are, you know, there's going to be cases, but it's really, that's not the issue. And putting masks on these kids and scaring them to death is the parents freaking out more than I think it's helpful for the kids.
On the vaccine issue, some news yesterday, a couple of bits. One, the Biden administration is going to start offering boosters September 20th or some such thing.
Yeah, that's when they're going to start.
Yeah.
And then at the same time, you have Rochelle Walensky, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, CDC, saying she has concerning indications that the vaccinations have a diminished impact on the Delta variant.
And your question for me is, do I trust either one of them?
Well, I suppose the question is, it just says like we're in, mask purgatory.
Yeah.
Are we going to be in vaccine booster purgatory in perpetuity?
I bet you we end up with an annual shot. I mean, if I had to bet on something, I'd bet on the fact that we're going to be like the flu. And, you know, every year we're going to come up with I wouldn't be surprised if it turns out to be like the flu and that we get people to get offered a shot every year with whatever variant is alive and coming from some other country.
Well, here in Chicago, this is our last day of facial freedom because tomorrow mask mandates go into effect. So that's what people were saying, you know, this perpetual motion, masks, vaccine, mask boosters. I mean, do you see? I mean, I can understand, yes, an annual flu shot, but do you think we'll have masks around till the end of time now?
Well, I hope not. I think I wrote something a couple weeks back in the City Journal, and I basically said somewhere we've got to tone down the sort of craziness of the noise, and some of this is tied to policy. Every time we ramp up policy, I mean, the booster shot I can think coming, but the mask stuff can't keep going up and down. It just can't. I mean, I agree with you that it's destructive to society at very deep levels, and we're getting caught on one little piece, which is putting masks on is the way we have to deal with the fact. And I think we've lost our center in this conversation. And I do think it's disruptive to, you know, people not wanting to start going out again. That's going to be the next thing, because now they have to go out and they put on a mask when they go out. They go indoors to a restaurant. And that just sort of creates this whole thing about people not wanting to engage in social and business environments. And that's destructive.
And again, the issue of therapeutics, and this is not part of the conversation, and it is part of the conversation with respect to the flu, which we've gotten used to. Yet another potential therapeutic, fluvoxamine, according to some research, I think in Toronto, which is an inexpensive antidepressant, curbed the number of COVID-19 patients ending up in the hospital by 13% with early treatment, making it a potential breakthrough treatment for COVID, according to a report in the National Post. So ivermectin, potentially fluvoxamine, are we going to have a conversation, or do we need to have a conversation about therapeutics that are going to also be with us if we're going to have an annual shot with us in perpetuity?
Yeah, I think actually that's a good thing, is that a lot of the therapeutics, which were finally pushed out of the gate, you know, later than some of the vaccines, all that when the number of cases of virus dropped, the pipeline, their ability to do the clinical trial sort of got impacted. now, unfortunately, they're back running the trials like Merck and a lot of people. And I actually think it's a positive thing if we can have some therapeutics that are effective other than just the antibody stuff that we can give now, the monoclonal antibody. And if we have treatments, then that even makes it even less crazy because, you know, it's just like, you know, if you come down with the symptoms and they can treat you over the counter with medicines, therapeutics, oral medicines, then it takes this whole craziness of the world ending. You know, the world is ending in other places. I mean, there's other places where this is just out of control. But in this country, we should not be going as crazy as we are. I know I'm probably outlawed on that. But
Unfortunately, you are an outlier on that, but so are we. So we appreciate the company. here's something, too. In this faceless, six-foot distance quarantine world we're creating for ourselves, this study in the Journal of Adolescence, since you're a pediatrician, former head of a children's hospital, good piece in Quillette about it, that looked at, it was research by Gene Twenge, Jonathan Haidt, Journal of Adolescence, a really significant study, examined loneliness among children, more than 1 million adolescents over 18 years, outcomes in 37 countries, and what they find is loneliness was generally stable from 2000 to 2012, then quickly reversed itself in all regions of the world in 2018. Nearly twice as many adolescents reported high levels of loneliness than just a half a decade early. And there's always going to be some intermittent loneliness. That's part of life and part of adolescence. But what they're talking about here is persistent loneliness because it seems to alter developmental pathways not easily corrected. And it's related to many adverse outcomes later in life, from depression to detrimental physical health manifestations. And so, you know, that's before COVID. So, when we were talking about things like screen time and isolation that way, but now we're sort of layering onto that. And this is like a real conversation that should be had, I think, based on this study.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the part you don't know is that I'm actually a board certified adolescent medicine physician. This is exactly, and what one of the things that did show up that sort of highlights this around the COVID part was the number of eating disorder patients. There's a network of providers who take care of adolescents with eating disorders, and there seemed to be a spike in eating disorders during COVID. This is something that we had a discussion about, and They started with this loneliness as a background, and then isolation, and then, you know, with kids having nothing to do. I mean, they weren't going out, they weren't socializing, and the impact of that was there was no way to sort of put a governor on sort of the self-injurious behaviors. And I think you and I have talked about this forever and ever and ever, it seems like, at this point, that the mental health impact, whether it's in the substance abuse arena, you have physical abuse that goes on in households. There's a whole other side to this that is just not put in the perspective of what we do when we start shutting things down and creating this panic that don't leave your house, don't engage in social activity, don't engage. And that's what's coming from all this. And the impact is horrible.
He is Dr. Jonathan Ellen, pediatrician, epidemiologist, CEO of Connections for Health, and former president and vice dean at Johns Hopkins All Children's Hospital. Dr. Ellen, thanks as always for your insights. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to podcasts of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.